On November 9th through the 11th, the Federalist Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Svetlana Gans. I'm a partner at Gibson Dunn and the chair of the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Executive Committee of the Federalist Society. I'd like to welcome you all here on behalf of my committee to the Fireside Chat with FTC Chair Lina Khan. Our committee is so thankful for Chair Khan to be here with us today and delighted for her to feature her priorities for the agency. Before I turn it over to Lina Katz of the Thought Leadership Project, I'd like to thank Federalist Society staff Nate Kuzmarek, Emily Manning, and Sam Fendler, as well as FTC staff Sarah Miller and Elizabeth Wilkins for their assistance with today's event. I'd like to wish everyone in the audience who is in the military or has served in the military a happy Veterans Day. And lastly, on a less patriotic note, to get CLE credit, attendees must sign in and out only once per day using the CLE QR codes found in your programs. The Federalist Society has been the home for robust thought leadership on the most important competition policy issues facing the nation today, from the consumer welfare standard to the proper role of administrative agencies in the free market economy. We have an array of webinars, podcasts, and blogs, and we welcome those interested in antitrust policy, including law students and young lawyers, to contact me or Nate Kuzmarek for more information. So with that, I'd like to welcome Alina Katz from the Thought Leadership Project to introduce the Fireside Chat. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Svetlana. I'm Alina Katz, Vice President for Strategic Initiatives at the Federalist Society and Director of the Freedom of Thought Project. Why are we here? Why is this the Freedom of Thought Fireside Chat? Just two thoughts. First, sadly, it's become useful, I think, to model good faith discussion. It is my sense that Todd Zwicky and Lina Khan might disagree on some things. It is also my sense that they do not fear that disagreement, but really embrace it. And I welcome this as part of the ongoing process for all of us in refining our own thinking. And then second, just on the substance, I have been intrigued by some of the themes in FTC Chair Lina Khan's work that resonate not just with the ideas that we are exploring with the Freedom of Thought Project, but that resonate also with some foundational ideas discussed within the Federalist Society. Her interest in the original understanding of antitrust statutes as essential to the rule of law is, of course, foundational, and her focus on structural protections against consolidated power in the private sector are reminiscent to me of how we might discuss vertical and horizontal structural protections for liberty in the constitutional context. And that is just part of why I am so looking forward to this morning's conversation. Confident that our speakers are well known, so very briefly, Lina Khan is the chair of the Federal Trade Commission. she wrote the Amazon's Antitrust Paradox while a 3L at Yale Law School, and led the congressional investigation into digital markets before joining the faculty at Columbia Law School, where she is currently on leave. Todd Zwicky is the George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at the Scalia Law School. He is also research fellow and former director of the Law and Economics Center, and perhaps most relevant on the long list of career accomplishments, served as the director of the Office of Policy Planning at the FTC. Professor Zwicky and Chair Khan, thank you so much for being here today. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Alina, and thank you, Chair Khan, for being here for this discussion. Welcome to the Federal Society. We appreciate having you here. I figure I would start this off by sort of, I'm working through these things, thinking through these things, that I've been intrigued by a lot of the things that you've said, and so I want to have a discussion, sort of first give you a chance to sort of flesh out your views, and then maybe ask you some questions. And as I was thinking about this conversation, it came to mind, Irving Kristol's old observation that a neoconservative is a liberal that has been mugged by reality. And I feel like I'm sort of, I'll say, a market fundamentalist who has been sort of mugged by reality over the last few years. As many of you know, several years ago, I sued my employer when they tried to force me to get vaccinated, and I already had had COVID. And the world has been very surreal since that time, and it's made me really think about a lot of the themes that the Chair Khan has been talking about for many years. What have we seen since it's? I've never spread a single word of misinformation. You can read my complaint that I filed in 2021. Everything I said in there was true then. It's true now. Since that time, I've had videos removed from YouTube. I've been shadow banned on Facebook. I've had people who I follow for medical advice disappear from Twitter. Google has manipulated search results with respect to the Great Barrington Declaration and other things that have been done. Brett Weinstein of the Dark Horse podcast has been demonetized. Everybody said, well, if you don't like it, start your own social media company. There was one. It was called Parler. You may remember what happened to Parler. And we've seen really what amounted to election interference with the suppression of news stories during the 2020 election, and we know one in particular. So I'm speaking for myself here, but what I have experienced over the last few years is this realization that there are these impacts on society. And I'm a little slow, I'm getting a little older, but I eventually came to realize that these are the kind of things that you and some of your colleagues have been talking about for some time, at least broadly, in terms of political influence, private power, and that sort of thing. And so I just invite you to kick us off by just telling us a little bit about how your thinking has progressed on this and how you think we should be thinking about these sorts of questions. So thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks so much. And let me just say, first of all, it's so great to be here. Happy Veterans Day. And thanks so much to anybody in the audience who serves. The FTC has a whole set of work devoted to protecting our veterans, and it's some of the most important work we do. And I so appreciate both Professor Zawicki and Alita for putting together this conversation, and just really admire the commitment to open-hearted and open-minded discussion and debate. So I want to pick up on something that you offered, which is a broader reassessment that's happening right now. And I think we see it happening across the political aisle, across the legal spectrum. And I think it's stemming from a clash between theories and models and reality. And I think what's coming from that is a renewed appreciation for the ways in which concentrated economic power, concentrated private power, can also pose a real threat to core liberties and the rule of law. And so for those of us who care about liberty, who care about the rule of law, recognizing not just the ways in which state power can threaten those core values, but the ways in which unchecked economic power can threaten those values, I see as such a rich area of discussion and debate at this moment. And so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So I got my started in this work through talking to chicken farmers. I was a business journalist and researcher, and one of my first assignments was to understand how had the poultry market evolved over the last few decades. And chicken farming as an industry is shaped like an hourglass. You have millions of consumers, thousands of farmers, and they're all connected by just a handful of companies. And talking to chicken farmers, it became clear that a lot of them were oftentimes dependent on just a single company for their economic livelihood, and that could lead to a whole set of coercive business practices. But what was really striking was, about a decade ago, the federal government was doing a whole set of listening sessions with chicken farmers, and they invited chicken farmers to come to these workshops and speak up. And at that time, chicken farmers, a whole set of them, actually decided not to show up. Not because they didn't want to, but because the chicken processors had threatened them and said, if you go and talk to the feds, we're going to retaliate against you. And so it was just a sharp illustration for me of the ways in which unchecked private power could also infringe some of our core rights, right? The freedom of speech, In ways that also, I think, deeply offend some of the core constitutional values. And it's been really interesting as we kind of go deep into the antitrust laws, the anti-monopoly tradition, to see how it was conceived of as a parallel to the kinds of checks and balances that we so take for granted in our political sphere. And there was a recognition that in the same ways that if you have unchecked concentration of public power, that that would pose a deep threat to liberty, that similarly you needed safeguards against the concentrations of economic power, and the antitrust and anti-monopoly laws were seen as a key form of those.
And that's one of the things I find striking about this, about all this, and your chicken farmer example is a good one. And when I look at the history, the original understanding of the antitrust laws, we do see, of course, consumer welfare discussed in there, and we'll come back to that. But we also see this sort of sense of competition and the like as being a social value in some sense, as you're saying, in terms of protecting core individual liberties and kind of the political process. Do you want to elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, I mean, look, as an enforcer, we really hew to the text of the statute and really want to be faithful to the laws that Congress has passed. And I think it's been really striking, and I think the discussion yesterday with Ashley Kelleher and Doha Mecki and some others was really interesting on this point. I think in some ways we've seen a departure from some of the core values and statutory interpretation tools that we ordinarily apply, that those have not been applied with as much fidelity in the antitrust context, and I think that's what's leading to a lot of the reassessment at this moment.
And so one of the things we hear, if we turn to economics, I understand your point, is when you sort of the cartoonish version of what you and DOJ is essentially, you're just saying big is bad, right? And which I assume you would disagree with. But tell us then, given all this, how does economics weigh, how do you weigh economic analysis with sort of the values of competition, the other sorts of goals that we see the antitrust laws trying to promote?
So as an enforcer, our goal is really to be faithful to the statutes. And the first thing to note is that there isn't just one statute. There are a whole set of statutes, right? We have the Sherman Act, which Congress passed in 1890, and then following the Standard Oil decision where the court introduced the rule of reason framework, Congress was really frustrated. They actually saw the rule of reason as a power grab by judges and said, hold up, we don't want the rule of reason to basically be a blank check for judges to import whatever social values they have into the law. We want, through the Clayton Act and through the FTC Act, want to create different statutory schemes, want to create the FTC to also be a set of experts who can be a, you know, complement to the case-by-case adjudication that we see. And so, you know, we try to honor the fact that there are three different statutory schemes and those have different statutes. And so one thing we've been looking to do with the FTC is making sure we're being fully faithful to the FTC Act in particular. So the FTC Act prohibits unfair methods of competition. And there's been an effort over the last couple of decades to read unfairness, the word unfair, out of our statute. I think there's been a sense from some enforcers that the word unfair is distasteful, and so let's just pretend it's not there, and let's just assume that the FTC Act and the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act are basically all in one the same. And as an enforcer, you know, that approach really worries me. I mean, I think that's enforcers and regulators substituting their own judgment and supplanting what's actually written in our statutes. And so our core principle has been to make sure we are fully enforcing the laws as written by Congress in a way that's consistent with what these statutes set out. Economics is a tool. It's a tool that can inform our analysis, but I do worry about tendencies that we've seen to import words that are not in our statute and let those words override what actually is in our statute, be it consumer welfare, be it forms of efficiencies. I was really struck by Ashley Kelleher's comments yesterday around how, even from a point of administrability, this has actually created a regime that's, you know, produced uncertainty, produced unpredictability, and so from a whole set of metrics, I think there's an impetus to really go back to some of the core values.
And let's pick up on that then, because as you've sort of alluded, you think that the antitrust has sort of gone in a different direction over the past several decades, maybe going back to the 80s, we'll just call it the short answer, the Chicago School Revolution. And one of the things I wonder about is, thinking back to that time, sort of the direction antitrust law took didn't really just kind of fall out of the sky, right? They didn't wake up one day and say, we need to, you know, turn the, Richard Posner and Robert Bork had it right. Let's just go for it. If you look back at the history, one of the reasons we had the antitrust laws develop, I think, was in the 60s and 70s, United States was, we had declining competitiveness globally, we had stagflation, we had high unemployment, we had sluggish economic growth, and there was a big movement at the time for regulatory reform that was bipartisan, started under Carter, airline deregulation, trucking deregulation, all that sort of stuff. And as part of that was reform of the antitrust laws. At least that's the way I see history. And so I'm curious how, you know, for somebody like me who's thinking about that, how should I think about what you're doing now in the sense the world's not less competitive now than it was then. A lot of the companies that we think about as the ones I was just criticizing, right? I think it's horrible that Amazon can and does essentially decide whether a book will get published. Think about that. One company can basically decide whether a book gets published because they have so much control over distribution. If they won't carry it, they're not going to publish it, right? So this is very dangerous, the private power, but at the same time, a lot of these, and I'm just speaking for myself, obviously, but a lot of these companies are also sort of global leaders, right? With competitiveness and that sort of thing. And in the 80s, it was Japan. Today, it's China. How should I be thinking about those issues and how sort of those general broader macroeconomic and global competitiveness issues relate to how we think about antitrust? That's a very long question. But
yeah, it's an important question, and I think it's a strain of the discussion that we hear a lot. And so look, back in the 70s, you know, we similarly faced these questions, right? And as the Justice Department was investigating AT&T, the Department of Defense said, hold up, you know, don't go ahead with this antitrust action because it's going to jeopardize our national security. Ultimately, we did see the Justice Department take action against AT&T. We saw the Justice Department take antitrust action against IBM, which led to the unbundling of the hardware and software. And those were some of the most important antitrust actions we had in that they actually positioned the U.S. to get ahead. They really sowed the seeds for the Silicon Valley Revolution, the microchips, the opening up of the Bell Labs patent vaults. And so I view that as actually a really key set of antitrust actions. And if you do a bit of a comparative advantage against, you know, Japan or parts of Europe that actually doubled down on their national champions, the U.S. ended up coming out ahead because those national champions, you know, weren't able to innovate in the same way. Similarly, we hear arguments today about how, especially with the large tech companies, that we should hold off against antitrust action because we need to protect these national champions. And I think that framework sometimes assumes that we're in some type of Cold War type arms race where these companies are exclusively advancing US interests. If you look closely, these companies are actually deeply ingrained in China. They're deeply integrated in China. They're looking to expand in China. And those types of economic dependencies can actually leave the US more vulnerable, right? And we've seen how some of these foreign states can use that economic leverage as a way to, you know, impose their own social values on the U.S. So we've heard about some companies censoring, changing the content of their products and services to please the political leaders of other countries. And so the entire paradigm here is a bit more scrambled when these companies have interests that may be aligned against U.S. national security interests. I think the other area where some of this comes to bear is in the context of our defense industrial base. And so for several years now, we've been seeing top military leaders come out and say the degree of consolidation that we see in our defense industrial base poses a risk to national security. This has happened across administrations, but it was really during the Clinton administration where there was a policy choice to spur consolidation. And so we've seen, 50 major defense contractors whittled down to 5 today. And so for major weapon systems, oftentimes the government is just dependent on 1 or 2 or sometimes 3 contractors. And that can be a problem both from the perspective of the government paying more, but also from the perspective of just challenges in scaling up at moments when you need. Take another example. Just a couple of years ago, there was a factory in Louisiana that blew up. And as a result of that one explosion, the U.S.'s production of a particular type of gunpowder, black powder, which is a really elementary input that has, hundreds of military uses, we no longer have any factories in the U.S. that produce that gunpowder. That factory is still offline. And so it's just another vivid example of how concentration of production can concentrate risk in ways that leaves us vulnerable from a national security perspective. And so those two examples strike me as areas where more competition and more antitrust is really what's going to promote our national interests rather than, propping up national champions, promoting consolidation, especially when you have such deep interests of these companies aligned with those in China.
And you're sort of talking now about, I think appropriately, about thinking about the other values of competition other than consumer welfare standard. And if we all recall the subtitle to Robert Bork's book, The Antitrust Paradox, is a policy at war with itself. One of the arguments he makes, and one of the arguments I hear is, and you alluded to this with describing Ashley Keller's comments yesterday, is the sort of rule of law values. And one of the concerns I hear expressed, and one of the things that Bork sort of describes is, yes, the consumer welfare standard is imperfect. It's kind of fuzzy around the margins, but in some sense, at least kind of tells us what the target is, right? Are you suggesting we kind of open up antitrust to something more than just consumer welfare? And then the follow-on question would be was, then how do we balance these sorts of goals? How do we get predictability if it's consumer welfare versus competition in some way, however that's diffused, or these other kind of concerns that I share with you about private power?
Yeah, so my colleague at the antitrust division, Jonathan Cantor, said the other month, if you ask 5 people what consumer welfare means, you're going to get 6 different answers, right? And so the idea that consumer welfare is this unified standard that everybody agrees what it means, I think is overstated. Initially it was seen by some to mean total surplus, then it was seen to mean consumer surplus. Now people have said, well, actually it means trading partner welfare, and actually it's also compatible with worker welfare. And so you have a term, its meaning seems quite slippery. That term is not in any of the statutes we've been charged with enforcing. And so I do think that this instead is an example of some of the very things that we should be worried about, right? Unelected bureaucrats supplanting their own standards into the text of the statute, and a world in which that standard is not even providing a single set of values across the board, is not providing a regime that's administrable, that's providing certainty. I think that has serious shortcomings.
Because when I look at the economics literature from the 60s and 70s, one of the things that's related to this is at that point when, and this is an area in which I think that it's less of a problem now than at least seemed to be at that time, was the literature, the economics literature, finds a lot of sort of public choice, interest group, political interference with the merger process and that sort of thing. And one of the arguments that it's been made is, do something other than consumer welfare, whatever that might mean, also raises the potential for more political interference, rent seeking, inefficient competitors protecting themselves from more efficient competitors and the like. Should I be concerned about that?
Yeah, Yeah, look, I mean, I think those are, you know, reasonable things to be worried about, though I think in practice what we see more is, you know, dominant firms and monopolists being best positioned to, you know, engage in regulatory capture at the expense of some of the smaller and independent firms. And I think, you know, these are some of the concerns that we hear today, including in the context of AI, where a lot of the startups are seeing, you know, the big tech CEOs be invited to Congress and are worrying, you know, are these big tech execs basically going to help craft regulations that are going to lock out startups and innovators? I think more generally, look, the Supreme Court has said the Sherman Act is a consumer welfare statute, and so as enforcers, we're bound by that. But this is where I think it becomes important to recognize that the Clayton Act and the FTC Act are separate statutes that are, you know, supposed to lay out different standards. And so one thing that we at the FTC have been doing is really going back to the text of the statutes, looking at all the precedent on the books. We put out a policy statement last year on Section 5 that was looking to move away from the effort to collapse the FTC Act onto the Sherman Act, which we didn't see as a faithful execution of the statute. And there we, you know, took the text of the statute seriously. It says unfair methods of competition, so it has to be a method of competition and it's unfair. Yes, unfair is broad, but let's look at what the courts have said unfairness means, right? And so we went through and read every single court decision where the court had actually interpreted what standalone Section 5 of the FTC Act actually means. And so I think these can be hard questions, but we have a tried and true set of tools that we apply when we're trying to figure out what does the text of a statute means. And it's just been really striking to me that antitrust is an area where all of those ordinary rules of the road have been suspended, and there is just this, you know, special and exceptional set of tools and modes of reasoning that get applied. And I think we should be wary of that.
And I think this is an important point that I had not really appreciated until I heard you in General Cantor talking about these questions, that we tend to think of everything as being the Sherman Act, right? We tend to, and I think it's perhaps it's because Bork's book has been so influential on thinking for people like me as well as the courts, but I think you're making an important point here, which is it's not just the Sherman Act. There's the FTC Act, there's the Clayton Act, and the like, and not all, and they were passed at different times, and not all the policies necessarily align perfectly with each other.
That's right. And in 1950, we had amendments to the Clayton Act because the Clayton Act was viewed as not adequately covering, you know, certain types of vertical mergers, certain types of conglomerates. And the political backdrop at that moment was really interesting because it was during the Cold War, and lawmakers were really worried that if we allowed economic consolidation, that would really open us up to the type of communism that we saw elsewhere. And there was a real recognition that preserving competition in our economic sphere was really critical for preserving liberty values in our political sphere.
One of the things, so you've talked a lot about, I think very interestingly, about structural protections for liberty that competition provides, and that really resonates with me in a very powerful way. One thing, when I talk to people about this and I raise this, one of the things that people say to me is, well, yeah, I get your point, but antitrust isn't the right tool, right? We should reform Section 230, or we should do common carrier regulation, these sorts of things. And, you know, my first question is, well, if you are concerned about government, why do you think that's a less intrusive way of regulating these things, or smaller government? But more generally, what do you say to somebody who says, well, antitrust isn't the right tool to get at these questions?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's for lawmakers to decide what's the right, you know, regulatory paradigm for different contexts. Traditionally, common carrier had been a key tool, especially in transportation and communications. And it was, you know, primarily applied to entities that policymakers had determined were affected with the public interest, right? Entities that had held themselves out to serve the public. And there was a worry that if you allowed these entities, be it the railroad or, you know, some type of telecom infrastructure, if you allowed them to discriminate, if you allowed them to choose who got to ride the rails and who didn't, that that was a form of outsized power that could have distortionary effects, be it in our economy or be it in our public discourse. And so I've been really interested by the move to redesignate some of these, you know, modern day forms of speech infrastructure, forms of common carriers. And I think some of the, you know, legal questions that are being teed up around that are really interesting. But I think fundamentally these are two different paradigms. Antitrust is about providing, you know, through competition, basically providing checks and balances and limiting the outsized power of any single entity. The common carrier regime is more about accepting that competition is going to be insufficient. And so if you're going to have concentrations of power, you need something like common carriage and non-discrimination to check the unfettered power, to check the ability for that entity to use its arbitrary power to pick winners and losers. And so I think directionally, these are both aimed at similar endpoints, but they're fundamentally, you know, doing it through different means.
And one of the things that's sort of dawned on me with respect to that is if you look at, say, and I won't ask you to comment, but if you look at, say, the Fifth Circuit case on the censorship, the first, you know, the First Amendment infringement cases of censorship, these highly concentrated industries make it much easier to collude to suppress speech, but it also makes it much easier for the government, in my opinion, to coerce. If you've only got a handful of social media companies you need to lean on rather than a lot of them, I think, you know, there's a structural protection there, it strikes me, against the government as well, that comes from this. One, we'll open it up. I think we'll have a couple minutes for questions from the floor, if you're okay with that. But I want to ask, so if you can move to the microphones if you like, but one area that you've tackled that I find very intriguing and is in this same vein about sort of antitrust policy is, one of the other things that is part of my being mugged by reality experience is something I'd never really fully appreciated before, maybe because I was a tenured professor, but employer power and the idea that my employer forced me, was trying to force me between take my health, literally my physical health from an unnecessary treatment, and my job that I love more than anything except for my wife and kids, my entire sort of, you know, reason for being. And luckily I was a tenured professor, luckily I got an exemption, but I heard from hundreds of people around the country who were coerced by their employers into deciding between their career and their jobs. And I know one of the things that you guys have tackled is covenants not to compete. But I just would invite you to sort of comment on that, sort of how you see that aspect of it. Employers, covenants not to compete, if you want to talk about that specifically. But why you see this as an FTC issue, sort of jurisdictionally.
So antitrust laws were designed to protect everybody, and there's a long history of recognizing that they also protect workers. The Supreme Court's decision in Alston a few years ago kind of, you know, ratified that once again. And our work on non-competes has been really interesting. I mean, this had been ongoing before I arrived at the agency, but over the last decade, there's been a whole set of empirical research finding that labor markets in the US are much more concentrated than previously assumed, that there's monopsony power being exercised by employers, and that that can result in a form of coercion. Non-competes in particular, you know, started off in the boardroom, but they've really proliferated across sectors, across income levels, so they're now applied to fast food workers, security guards, to, you know, engineers, journalists. And when you look at the empirical research, we found that, you know, this is harming the workers who are covered by the non-competes, but also those who are not covered by them. And that there is a harm to competition. So we hear from startups and new businesses that are able to get financing, they're able to, you know, start entering the market, but then they quickly hit a ceiling in terms of how much they can scale because they're all the relevant workers are locked up through non-competes. As part of this work, I actually also got a chance to talk to some religious liberty advocates, and they were sharing how, you know, especially over the last few years where you've seen people feel coerced by their employers and wanting to exercise, you know, religious liberties, that the existence of non-competes, which can really eliminate a whole set of really important exit options can also then limit people's ability to exercise those core rights. And so I think we see from a whole set of ways how these can, you know, the employer-employee relationship can intrinsically be coercive, but then these non-competes can kind of further make that coercion more acute in ways that I think can be a problem from a competition perspective, but also from what you're noting. I also wanted just to go back briefly to your point around the structural protections, because revisiting the Fifth Circuit opinion, I was struck by analogs that we see between overbreadth doctrine and what's that designed to do from a First Amendment perspective, right? Where it basically says that there are certain forms of restraints that are so intrinsically problematic because they're having a chilling effect, right? And so you don't need to have an actual exercise of government power. The mere possibility of it through certain types of statutory schemes is intrinsically problematic because it's chilling speech. I think there are analogs to that in antitrust and anti-monopoly, where it was recognized that certain types of concentrations of power, certain types of mergers created structures that could intrinsically create certain types of chilling effects on pro-competitive behavior, such that you don't have to show, you know, endless types of key certain effects because the structure itself would create risk. And so I think there's really just interesting analogs between parts of First Amendment doctrine and parts of antitrust doctrine that we've seen historically as well.
Interesting. Could go to a question from here in the front, and then I'll go to the mic and back next.
Hello, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you very much. Todd, thank you. I'm John Hsu from Newport Beach, California. And thanks for coming. Would you, Madam Chairwoman, would you please describe your concerns, if any, on whenever the FTC or any other regulatory agency takes action, antitrust action, the balancing between protecting competition as opposed to not protecting competitors? Thank you.
Yeah, so this often gets kind of posed as a dichotomy, and you know, there are instances in which protecting competition or protecting competitors can be in tension with protecting competition, but I think there's also a basic way in which you need to have competitors to have competition, right? Or the potential of competitors to enter a market. And so I think, honestly, this dichotomy is a little oversimplified. As a practical matter, you know, we look at the specific facts, we look at are there entry barriers, we look at if it's a merger case, you know, are there presumptions being met? And so it ends up being a case-by-case analysis, but I do worry about the ways in which that dichotomy being superimposed can kind of, you know, turn us away from wanting to make sure that structurally we're preserving the opportunity for competition, which includes preserving the opportunity for competitors to come into the market. So, you know, I think our laws and our the judicial process are very well equipped to make sure that the antitrust laws are not being weaponized in any way to serve any particular interest. You know, when putting together our cases, we certainly interview third parties, but we have other investigative tools. We also look at what do the documents say, you know, what does the economics say. So it's, you know, not like cases are put together exclusively because you have complaining parties. You know, you really need to do a full 360.
Because that is, I think, one of the big questions. When I look at the legislative history, what I see is when they, that like the Clayton Act, when you talk about competition, it's kind of ambiguous, right? Which is they talk about it in terms of good competition when we think about it, but it's also pretty clear a lot of those things had a, to me at least, that a lot of the antitrust laws were protecting competitors, right? From more efficient competitors, you know, the research on the Swift meatpacking company and local antitrust laws to block them. We have the whole experience that Tim Muris has talked about with A&P, these sorts of things. And I think it seems like that's the hard line to navigate, or at least is what Bork suggests, is to try to, how do you keep protection of competition from collapsing in the protection of inefficient competitors?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I read the common law, and I think there's actually a lot more room for academic work on kind of, you know, researching the deep common law and the kind of originalist understanding of antitrust, is that a lot of the common law, including at the state level, was designed to distinguish between permissible and impermissible forms of competition, right? So it's impermissible to compete by colluding, right? Colluding with your rival and trying to through that compete against one of the other big guys in the market. It is permissible through, you know, having more to compete by having greater operational efficiencies, right? And so I think, you know, the language of competition as a standalone doesn't really serve us well in terms of what is the underlying analytical inquiry. This is where I think the FTC Act's text, unfair methods of competition, creates a better anchor for realizing what we're doing is distinguishing between methods of competition, which ones are permissible and which ones are impermissible. There aren't always going to be easy answers, but I do think that some of that history provides a roadmap.
Interesting. So for all the law students, there's, you know, if you want to write your third year note on the common law of antitrust, maybe someday you too could be chair of the FTC. I'll take a question in the back from the mic in the back.
Mark Chenoweth, president of the New Civil Liberties Alliance. It was our honor to represent Professor Zawicki in his successful lawsuit. But my question for Chair Khan is, you know, I was struck by your professed fidelity to the statute, the Clayton Act and the FTC Act. I wonder if you would further that fidelity by pledging to eschew non-statutory merger conditions in the future at the FTC.
Now you know why I liked having him as my lawyer.
So we just issued draft merger guidelines this summer, and you know, as leading up to that, we went back and looked at, you know, every litigated merger decision and wanted to make sure that these merger guidelines were being fully faithful to the text of the Clayton Act, but also the precedent. One thing we found when looking closely at prior iterations of the merger guidelines was that in some instances, the guidelines actually had departed from the case law on the books. And so that's been, you know, core to that inquiry. We got thousands of comments. We're currently in the process of digesting them. One thing I've shared publicly is sometimes we get companies coming before us saying, you know, we know the merger is problematic from a competition perspective, but let us make certain ESG commitments to you all to wave that through. And we firmly reject that, those types of ESG commitments or ESG promises or any other types of, you know, social justice type commitments can never rescue an illegal merger. And so we, you know, tried to make clear that firms should not come to us with those types of non-statutory commitments because we really are bound by the text of the law.
And on this point, how it sounds like what you're saying is you feel like the case law has departed from the original understanding. Are you saying, are you guys attempting to overturn precedent, or are you guys seeing the distinguished precedent? How should we, you know, like the Wall Street Journal, for example, has made much of your one loss record, for example, and a lot of people have said this is kind of contrary to where the law has been. How do you respond to critics who talk about how this fits with the precedent that has been built up over time?
So the guidelines are entirely anchored in the case law, in the legal precedent. Including, you know, major Supreme Court decisions, major decisions from the Court of Appeals. These are decisions that get cited routinely in modern-day antitrust decisions. You know, one distinction, one change that we saw around mid-century is, you know, before I believe it was the 1970s, we had something called the Expediting Act, where antitrust cases that were appealed by the Justice Department, the Supreme Court had to take up. And so just through the 70s, you have much more Supreme Court jurisprudence on antitrust than we've seen since then. And so some people use that to suggest, well, these, you know, major cases from mid-century are just outdated, they're no longer in fashion. Right. We don't take that view. And actually, even if you look at modern day merger decisions from the courts, they too are citing these same decisions, which are kind of key pillars of antitrust jurisprudence. How they get applied, you know, in modern markets is going to differ slightly than how we applied them in the smokestack context. But we don't think it's for us as enforcers to just decide that because case law is old, it's just out of fashion. We kind of have to wait for it to be overruled.
Well, I think with that, we are out of time because we have lunch. I want to say thanks for being here with us.
Thanks so much.
And you're welcome back anytime. So thanks for being here.
So much.